And now back to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. Here are the You Docs, Dr. Michael Roizen and Dr. Arthur Perry.
And Arthur, there was a new study out this week that maybe cosmetic surgeons don't need anesthesiologists to watch over their patients during surgery. What's your take on this?
I thought you'd like that one, Mike.
I'm obviously prejudiced because people should know that I'm an anesthesiologist as well as an internist. So I feel that, even if you only kill one in a thousand by doing it yourself, you still should have an anesthesiologist there to protect you as the patient.
Well, I'll tell you, it's certainly one of the best investments you can make. That is to have an anesthesiologist at your procedure. You know, surgeons who think that they can give sedation and operate, I'll just tell you right off the bat, Mike, they're out of their minds. you know, this study looked at 218 surgical procedures where the doctor, where the surgeon also gave the sedation. And these were not just taking moles off. These were things like breast augmentations, and facelifts and things like that. And the surgeon who's got a big responsibility, and that is to make an incision, to do a surgical procedure, to stop bleeding, to sew up.
And to get an artistic result.
Exactly. Should have very undivided attention to the task that he or she is doing. Now, what does it mean to provide sedation to a patient? For listeners out there, Mike's an anesthesiologist, but it is not just giving a few drugs, but it's monitoring the blood pressure and heart rate and EKG and oxygenation and making sure the patient is comfortable and not anxious. And there's a whole art to it, which is why how many years do you have to train to be an anesthesiologist, Mike?
Four years.
So you're
constantly doing it. The reason I don't do it anymore, I retired from it about 2.5 years. You've got to do it at least 2 to 3 days a week to be any good at doing it consistently. So I have. So when I couldn't do it that often, I have to retire from this, if you will.
But I'd take you in a second over me. Providing the sedation for patients.
Well, that's right. You actually get very good at resuscitation. You get very good at making sure the patient doesn't get to the point where they need some emergency care. It's constant monitoring. I don't understand how a surgeon could be constantly monitoring and constantly focusing on the cosmetic result. I think maybe the cosmetic results in the study weren't as good. If the surgeon were paying enough attention to the anesthesia.
Right. You know, and you may not know this about me, Mike, but I wrote the regulations in the state of New Jersey for office anesthesia and the surgical standards. And New Jersey mandated the use of an anesthesiologist to provide sedation and, of course, general anesthesia. A surgeon cannot do it him or herself. In the state of New Jersey, and that is very, very important. Very important. And listeners out there, there's certain things you can cut corners on in life. You know, you can buy the 26-inch TV instead of the 60-inch TV, but don't chintz and don't try to save money by having
on your safety, your life.
Right. And I'll tell one anecdote. I had a colonoscopy when I was in my 20s, and the gastroenterologist gave the sedation himself, and it was extremely uncomfortable. I'll never forget it. And the next time I had a colonoscopy when there was an anesthesiologist, I'll never forget the words were, "We're going to start. We're going to, okay, we're done now." And that's it. The difference is remarkable when you have nicely performed sedation, and it's much, much safer for patients. So regardless of this study that was published, I think it's very self-serving. Why do surgeons want to give sedation? And it's terrible. The answer is because they want to save money for their patients, thereby making themselves more competitive. They want lower fees, but for their patients, so that their patients can go to them as opposed to someone else who uses an anesthesiologist. That's a terrible reason to not have an anesthesiologist, but that's the truth.
Arthur, we're going to now go to the real age tip of the week. I typically miss it, so I'm going to make sure we get it. This one, peppermint oil, proven resolve.
Now on You, the Owner's Manual, this is the Real Age Tip of the Week with Michael Roizen, MD.
And Arthur, I was going to ask you what you thought of this one. What is peppermint oil proven to resolve? Upset stomach. Don't you love it when science solves the mystery of a time-honored home remedy? It happened again, and to one of our favorite digestion soothers, peppermint. Turns out this ancient herbal tummy tamer does its thing by switching off pain-sensing nerve fibers in your digestive system. Who knew? That helps explain why pouring yourself out a steaming mug of peppermint tea for an upset stomach, or popping an enteric-coated peppermint oil capsule to ease irritable bowel syndrome, we call it IBS, really works. We've known that for a while, that mint relaxes smooth muscle in your GI tract, which can tone down IBS cramps. That's super useful if you're among one in five people with this uncomfortable problem. Now, we also know it can mute, that is, turn off, hypersensitive nerves, which can trigger the internal distress after a spicy meal, too much coffee, a glass of wine, or during the flu. Peppermint tea may be all it takes to smooth a queasy stomach or settle one that's too gassy or bloated, but it may take a stronger dose to ease IBS. That's where peppermint oil capsules come in. To give them a try, stick with 0.2 to 0.4 milliliters of oil 3 times daily and use only enteric-coated versions to avoid heartburn. Otherwise, the muscle-relaxing oil could relax a valve at the top of your stomach, allowing acid to backwash into your esophagus, and that hurts. Fifth, if you're heartbone prone, skimp the mint-chewing gum for the same reason. The real age benefit of controlling your own health, about 12 years younger. And that's the real age tip this week. Arthur, what do you think? Have you ever tried peppermint tea?
No, I haven't, but I eat candy canes. Does that work, Mike? Tell me.
Oh, God. Thank you, Sonar, for great engineering this week. Arthur Ferry, Gary Ginsberg, Joe Galuski, and you, of course, for listening. This is Dr. Mike. You can always send us questions at UDOCS, Y-O-U-D-O-C-S, @gmail.com. That's Y-O-U-D-O-C-S. Now come back. We'll be back next week. Great guests and a great show coming up. Dancing with the Stars winner and trauma victim.
Sometimes people buy cookies as a gift for us to send to our soldiers. They tell us it reminds them of home.
Emily is one of thousands of Girl Scouts who will send cookies to troops stationed overseas.
Children shouldn't have to take abuse because they aren't strong enough to escape it. I want to give them a helping hand.
Alicia uses proceeds from her cookie sales to provide mentoring programs at a shelter in her community.
Selling Girl Scout cookies has taught me how to manage money, be responsible, and talk to other people.
Tanya wants to go to business school and hopes to run her own company someday.
On a visit to the food bank, I learned that in this economy, more and more people need help to feed their families.
Morgan and other Girl Scouts are starting a project to help get food to those who need it most. Every Girl Scout cookie has a mission, to help girls do great things. Find your cookies now at GirlScoutCookies.org.
With the American Academy of Pediatrics, I'm Dr. Don Schifrin. The U.S. is experiencing an increase in the number of cases of whooping cough. This is a serious illness caused by pertussis bacteria. It often starts with what seems like a common cold. Then, especially for toddlers, the cough worsens and leads to the characteristic whoop sound on inhaling. During this phase of the illness, which usually lasts more than 2 weeks, the child can get short of breath and the skin around the mouth may turn blue. Older children may cough so hard they vomit. The illness can be particularly deadly for infants who can develop complications such as pneumonia and seizures. Whooping cough is highly contagious and can spread to children who have not been vaccinated. The best way to prevent this dangerous illness is to be sure your child received all doses of the pertussis vaccine. This is usually given as the DTaP vaccine. And for more information on preventing whooping cough, visit www.cisp.org.